So I think it's very important when you are doing change to do two things. Number one is to over-communicate and to make sure that you do so at the right level where possible. So if you've got 100 pieces of information to communicate, you got to have a strategy for who gets to see all 100, who gets to see a subset of that, who gets to see a subset of that. And so that's part of the approach that I think is important. And then the second one is to identify who's going to be a change agent for you, somebody who's going to help with the culture change.
Welcome to the All Things Ops podcast. On this show, we interview leaders in IT operations, DevOps, and AI ops about the ever-changing world of running an organization's technology. With our guests, we dive into things like, what does it mean to run large-scale IT infrastructures? How do you manage globally distributed operations? What are the complexities of hybrid IT? How can you best leverage automation? And last, but definitely not least, how do you keep an eye on things using monitoring and observability? This podcast is produced by Tribe29, the company behind CheckMK, the software of choice when it comes to monitoring hybrid IT infrastructures. I'm Elias Volker, and I will be your host today.
Hey, everybody. My guest for today's episode of the All Things Ops podcast is Juan Cercos. Juan is Senior Director DevOps at Development Alternatives Incorporated. He started his career in application support by education. He's an aerospace engineer and then was for more than 17 years in various IT management roles at Fannie Mae before joining DAI. Juan, it's great to have you on the All Things Ops podcast. Welcome.
Thank you, Elias. It's very good to be here. I'm excited about the conversation.
All right, good. Well, to get us started, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get to where you are today?
Sure. So as you mentioned, I, by trade or by school, I'm an aerospace engineer. I started in IT, though, in the year 2000 after getting my master's. And after 6 months at a startup, I basically started working for a company called Fannie Mae, which is one of the largest, if not the most complicated financial institution in the U.S., and went through all of the financial crisis with them, stayed with them for about 20 years. I spent about 13 years in the production support space, the first three as an engineer, breaking applications, most of the time saving applications, writing a lot of scripts, and then about 12, 13 years as a production support manager, where I managed all different sorts of portfolios. A company that big usually breaks out their portfolios of applications into, let's say, credit applications or loan underwriting applications. So I moved from portfolio to portfolio, fixing different issues. After that, I did about a year of QA management, 1 year of IT service delivery management, a year of development, and then the last 4 years at Fannie Mae, I manage the SCM team, and we kind of transformed the SCM on-prem team over the course of 4 years into a cloud-first AWS, fully automated CI/CD pipeline DevOps team. And that was a really exciting portion of my career. Those last 4 years, we were able to migrate some major applications to the cloud there. And then after that, I decided it was a good time for a change in atmosphere. Fannie Mae was a little bit too large to have influence unless you rose through the ranks. So I wanted to have a little bit more of an influence in the overall direction of a company. So I decided to kind of leave Fannie Mae. And that's when I actually met the CIO of DAI and got recruited by them to originally come in to be a DevOps director and eventually, and we'll get into some of that, take over most of the IT practice in that company. And so I've spent the last 18 months at DAI basically managing all sorts of things that again, we'll get into.
All right. Good. Great. Before we get into that, as you mentioned, tell us a little bit what DAI does.
Sure. So DAI stands for Development Alternatives Incorporated, and it is in an industry that's called international development. And it took me about 3 weeks after joining the company to realize that the development in that sentence does not refer to IT development. It refers to old school development. So you're talking about dams, you're talking about irrigation systems. So essentially what this company does and what international development does is it's a set of companies that essentially administer projects for clients like USAID, The UK government, Her Majesty's government, the EU, and then some foundations like the Gates Foundation. And so these have to do anything from irrigation projects in Uganda to helping with fair election systems in other countries. So it's a very interesting mission statement and a very interesting place to work at.
All right. You mentioned that you've been with the company for roughly 1.5 years now. What are some successes that you have achieved during that time, and where do you still have your work cut out for you?
Right. So I originally came in to be a senior DevOps director, and within a few weeks, it was quickly realized that the company wasn't quite ready for DevOps, right? So DevOps is a sort of automation of agile practices, which would imply you've got an agile practice, and the company wasn't quite there. So the role transformed from DevOps director to kind of managing overall IT. And so some of the things that we were able to do was implement agile across the company and instantiate a backlog, which again, it was a hard thing to do because we didn't get to necessarily bring in a lot of coaching. It was more organically done through coaching and a lot of meetings. Explain to folks what a story is, what a feature is, which is not normally what a DevOps director spends their time in. So that was one of the successes, because we ended up going from a perceived backlog of 200 stories or so, or work items when I got there, to once we actually did the instantiation exercise, we realized the volume was actually more like 1,500 a month, which is quite an increase. We also created the first SRE team, Site Reliability Engineering Team, which is something I'm quite proud of now, having been able to do in two places, Fannie Mae and the AI. And that was in order to be able to eliminate toil and create capacity, because when you don't have a lot of money to invest in new resources, the only way you can truly innovate is to first chunk out some capacity, existing capacity. We also implemented the first really metrics program in the company. So a whole lot of ITIL metrics, agile metrics, MTTR, you name it. We implemented an AI and ML-based proposal document solution, which basically kind of grabs bits and snippets from different successful proposals that the company has done, and then does some AI and ML on it to actually come up with new proposal documents and potentially successful paragraphs for potential bids, et cetera. And so that was very interesting. And then a few other tools like, you know, enterprise searches, et cetera. And then we transitioned from low code solutions to a full stack team, more, you know, trying to develop actual enterprise applications. And then we've obtained, as I mentioned, buying for the digital transformation approach, which is to shift more from trying to bring in some fancy tools to first actually doing some core data analytics and some stabilization of the company, and then actually moving into the next stage. So those are some of the things that I'm quite proud of having been able to accomplish in just 18 months.
And what are sort of some of the big buckets of work that are still in front of you? Where do you see
there are multiple big challenges. Number one is the financial outlook, which makes a lot of the budgeting decisions and convincing people to invest a challenge. So that's one of the challenges, is to convince companies that are trying to potentially contract or be very careful with their investment that there are strategic investments to be had. So that obviously is going to be a shift over the course of the next 12 months versus the last 12 months where there was not a perception that there was a recession coming. And then the second one is to continue to convince a company. This company is a company that was basically staffed by people whose average tenure is about 20 years with the company. So it's IT and procurement and legal folks who basically learned their craft at the company. So then convincing them to continue to learn, continue to be open, and continue to think forward, essentially. So those are the two main challenges that I still see out there over the next 12 months.
Particularly the second one sounds, I mean, you've already, seems like, introduced a lot of change into your organization. There seems to be more change coming, if I understand you correctly. How do you manage and drive this, particularly in such an international context? You mentioned you have people in 15 different countries. What were the easy parts? What are things that were maybe harder to implement?
So that's a great question. So I think it's very important when you are doing change to do two things. Number one is to over-communicate and to make sure that you do so at the right level where possible. So if you've got 100 pieces of information to communicate, you got to have a strategy for who gets to see all 100, who gets to see a subset of that, who gets to see a subset of that. And so that's part of the approach that I think is important. And then the second one is to identify who's going to be a change agent for you, somebody who's going to help with the culture change, who's going to be a change, let's say, a change promoter, so somebody who's slightly below from a change aptitude perspective, who's going to be a change denier, and then eventually who are going to be your saboteurs, which almost in every organization, when you have big change, you have that. So a combination of those two. And I do believe that one of the things that is very important is to leverage digital communication tools. So when you have a globally spread team, it is important that you don't necessarily make all of the communications synchronous communications. So if you are very meeting heavy in a globally spread team, then you're going to have some strain in the schedule of folks. So the best way to counter that is to kind of overcompensate with the use of things like Confluence, Jira, Azure DevOps, MS Teams, and then to make sure that everybody kind of understands what they fit in. I also think it's very important to check in often via metrics and informally via rhetoric to see how things are going. And then finally, I think it's very important to be ready to pivot. So throughout my whole career, I will have a strategy that I would approach a problem with. And almost to a fault every single time, I've had to pivot that strategy because new data would come in, new information would come in, or new events would happen or take place that would basically warrant that pivot. So those combinations of events, to me, eventually make sure that a large mass of people have buy-in on a change and eventually move in the same direction together, if that makes sense.
So I have two follow-up questions.
Yeah.
One on what you mentioned. You mentioned people a lot, and you've hardly talked about tools. And in a previous discussion that we had, you said there's sort of the three pillars. There's the technology, there's processes, and there's people. Now, if you think about your change, let's say, agenda that you've already gone through and that you're still going through, what percentage, if you can say, of it is related to tools and technology? What percentage is allocated to changing processes? You mentioned agile, for example. And what percentage is actually sort of people driven?
So I think that's a great question. And as you and I talked, beforehand, right? The thing that I think separates me from a lot of IT leaders is I actually believe people come first. Making sure you've got a team that works themselves out of a job, that has the right attitude, the right culture, and the right retention rates. And then having the right processes in place to make sure that guardrails are in place where they need to be. And more importantly, that guardrails are not in place where they don't need to be, and that people don't insert themselves into positions. And then the final one is tools, right? So to me, the tools are the things that are agnostic to who you are. So essentially, they pick themselves if you've got the right people and the right process in place. To answer your actual question, which is the percentage in this current situation that we're in, I would say about 50% of the investment has really been on process, making sure that we've got the right incident management, the right change management, the right problem management, the right vendor management, a lot of reviewing SOWs, and then the right agile practices. So that's at least 50% of it. I'd say 30% has actually been on people, making sure we've got the right investment in people, the right coaching. Some attitudes might need to be changed. Some teams might need to be reshaped. And then the remaining is really tools, right? How many tools do we have to do parsing of code? How many tools do we have for scanning of libraries? Do we need all of those tools? Did we have those tools because person A brought in the tool that they used at their first company, and then person B brought in the tool that they used at their other company, and we end up with a melange of tools? So the remainder has been a lot of tool rationalization, et cetera. So I'd say 50, 30, 20 probably.
Okay. My experience tells me that oftentimes these percentages are exactly the other way around. So I hear where you're coming from. So my second follow-up is to something that you sort of mentioned in passing, you know, changing your strategy as you acquire new data. And you mentioned, as we've talked before, you are a big fan of data-driven decision-making. Can you give us an example, maybe related to, let's say, the implementation of SRE practices and removing toil as maybe if a concrete example comes to mind, of what kind of data you used in your decision making when it came to introducing this role, this practice, and what toil to remove first?
Okay. Yeah, so I am very passionate about data-driven, and I think it stems from my initial production support days. It's from 2 a.m. conference call, 3 VPs from 4 different customers yelling at everybody, and you're convinced it's the load balancer until suddenly out of the corner of your eye, you see that there's a row-level lock of the Oracle database. And you've been telling everybody for an hour and a half it's the load balancer. Well, the quicker you realize that new data throws your whole theory out the window, the quicker you're going to recover from your outage. So I think from those days on, I came very aware that the computer eventually is going to tell you what the truth is in spite of your best efforts to make up a story. And so to your question on SRE implementation, I've had to do this 2 times. The first one was at Fannie Mae, and that was by actually taking over a team that was doing manual deployments for and supporting manual deployments for about 2,000 developers in the company, and had been stuck in a pattern of basically no capacity to innovate, to upgrade their tools, et cetera, for about 3 years. And so we did a lot of incident, problem, and change management analysis to basically see where are people spending their time, and then what are the biggest time consumers for people that we could automate. So a lot of it had to do with taking a look at, for example, common service requests, and then implementing a self-service approach so that instead of somebody manually adding some configuration to a server after getting a ticket, well, the ticket is automatically read, it's parsed, and the configuration is added automatically. When you happen to do those things, you can actually start actually reducing the toil and incrementing the capacity of any team. So by doing that and being able to extract all of that data, I was able to first prove that we had a Phoenix project type situation, if you've ever read the book, basically a situation where you have an infinitely decreasing capacity, right? Where if you don't do something about it, the availability of your development team is going to go from 8 to 6 to 4 to 3 to 2 to eventually nothing. And by convincing people that if we didn't do something about it, we wouldn't change, we were able to then get some investment to actually create a site reliability engineering team. And one of the things that we were really successful with was to make sure that every single automation that we did had an entry in a operational database as to record the utilization of it. So that if I automated a process for you that you were doing 5 times a week for 5 hours, every single time that new automated process was executed, it would log the execution, therefore being able to provide metrics that you could take to management saying, look, we've just saved the company $1.5 million through these 27 automations that now got executed 35,000 times, saving the company 4,500 man hours a week. And so to me, that is a good example of using data. I could give you a couple others, and they have to do with being given a task. Like, for example, there was a FHFA audit of Fannie Mae, and the premise that FHFA, our regulator, had was that the production incidents at the time were due to a lack of mirrored lower environments. And I was able, and the task I got was replace all the lower environments with mirror copies of production, which at the time was a $10 million project. And that was the task. But quickly through looking at initial data, I started seeing that the stipulation by FHFA was wrong. There were high level of incidents, but the root cause was not a lack of lower environments. It was a lack of regression testing. So I was able to convince both FHFA, the government, and Fannie Mae that the actual solution was to implement regression testing and automated regression suites instead of mirroring the environments. Saved about $3 million a year and successfully met all the requirements. So those are 2 examples of just using data, different types of data. One of them is IT and operational. One of them is more application to come up with new conclusions that were not there before, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, those are great examples. You mentioned the work on the deployment pipelines that you did at Fannie Mae, and I think this is a project that you are also very, very passionate about. I note in my notes from our pre-interview conversation, I noted by making 3 small changes in 9 months, we were able to automate. We were able to automate the full pipeline and move 900 applications to the cloud. So I do have to ask, what were those 3 small changes?
Okay. Yeah. And so a couple of things on that. First, to kind of set the stage. So for about 2 years, Fannie Mae had been trying to automate some pipelines and to move applications to the cloud. In this particular case, it was AWS. We also had some Salesforce and some Azure, but mostly AWS. And for 2 years, unsuccessful. Lots of money spent, 5 IBM consultants on site to try to work with their pipeline tool, no results. And so when I took over for that team to try to get some results, the initial instinct is, well, let's replace the team with new folks. But we couldn't do that. We had to use the existing team. So these are the 3 changes that we made. It was actually 4. But the first one was implementing the SRE team to actually free up capacity, which we've already talked about, which then freed up the, let's say, the support engineers and the regular engineers to actually become developers. The second one was to change the way that IBM, the consultant, the vendor that owned the tool, was being implemented or leveraged. We had been previously just assigning stories and work items to them, and they had been almost like hero developers, just coding pipelines. And if you're trying to do that with 5 people for a team of 2,000 developers, you're almost always going to be chasing your own tail. So what we decided to do is, instead of leveraging them as high-end developers, let's leverage them as high-end trainers. And let's change all of their work items from code deliverables to knowledge acquisition and knowledge transfer, coaching the entire team of full-timers to actually code the pipelines, Python, whatever was needed, Puppet, you name it. And then the final change that we made was to go from a tool-centric approach where we were trying to solve the technical issues of the Selenium to SonarQube to Jenkins to Maven integration to actually look at why those integrations were failing. And what we found out is that in most cases, it was actually politics and people. So because it was a large company, there was a different team that owned the cloud, that owned Linux, that owned Oracle, that owned security, that owned testing, that owned release management. And in most cases, what happened is those teams were unable to produce repeatable documented processes that you could integrate. So then a lot of the work went into just meeting with those teams and making sure they understood what the pipeline was expecting of them to actually integrate. And by doing those 3 things, we were able to actually onboard 400 assets onto the pipeline, move them onto the cloud, all 400, and not just a simple move of code, but environment instantiation with Kubernetes, with scanning of environments, automated unit testing, automated code checking, automated deployment, automated destruction of environments, all of that for 400 applications in just 9 months. So it was quite a success story. And then the final change that I forgot to mention was we changed the product ownership from one single guru type engineer that have had it for 2 years to more like a team-based approach led by a single engineer lower level that was a lot closer to the platforms and then empowering that engineer with agile practices. And that was it. In about 9 months, we kind of totally turned it around. And I think we ended up with one of the more sophisticated pipelines out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds like an extremely exciting, probably also slightly stressful time, I imagine, because that's a lot of work to be done in 9 months. But you know, when I talk to you, I really feel that you're very passionate about these DevOps principles and about, you know, CI, CD pipelines and all of that. But the one thing, and this I think shown through as well in what you just described, is one thing that you do take issue with is sort of the tool perspective that the people take on this. And you argued that, you know, we should look at things much more from a capability perspective. And can you expand on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is, and you are right, this is something I'm extremely passionate about. So I've spent my whole life in IT hearing people say, he's technical, she's technical, or this tool sucks, that tool sucks. And I'm here to say there is no such thing as a bad tool, and there is no such thing as a non-technical person. There's just not. It's not. So then my first 2 philosophies in IT management are work yourself out of a job, and this will come into play. And then people first, then process, then tools, which we talked about. And how does that play into the capability-led design? If you are designing a pipeline, you can actually spend hundreds of hours talking about two different tools for testing that you're going to integrate without spending one single hour talking about your actual testing practice and your actual testing requirements. And so to me, the right way to design not just CI/CD pipelines, but really any IT solution is to think capabilities first. There's way too much talk about tools without really understanding that there is no such thing as a bad tool, and just not enough talk about requirements sometimes. What are you really trying to solve? And the reason I say that is because I think that a lot of times in IT, I've seen implementation, successful implementation, conflated with success. And to me, success is not just implemented what an IT team has been told to implement, but actually going beyond and making sure that whatever was implemented is of value, if that makes sense. And that's something that has come into play a little bit more with lean product development and some of the other waves and kind of movements that have come into the last few years. But I still think people still tend to go to the one tool they know, the one set of tech stacks that they know, without really ever understanding that there's almost an infinite amount of combinations of tools and tech stacks that can solve any one technology implementation or any one technology issue. It's more around understanding what the issue is so that you don't over-engineer and that you don't over-provision, if that makes sense. So then to me, when you're thinking about CI/CD pipelines, before talking Jenkins, Mavens, Puppet, or any other tools, I prefer to talk in terms of release management, library security, code versioning, testing, unit testing, environment provisioning. Those capabilities understood well will then dictate whether you have a Terraform solution or a CloudFormation solution or what combination of tools you actually end up with. And so to me, in my career, it's actually paid very much to make sure I stop and I think about capabilities first before thinking tools. And what that has done as a side result is that I've ended up learning a lot of tools that I never thought I would learn. Because of course, mm-hmm. if you're actually thinking capabilities, then the solution is almost very likely not going to be the tool that you're already familiar with, if that makes sense. So then I actually think this expands beyond CI/CD pipelines, and it expands to ERP tools, which I've seen a lot of, movements to change an ERP tool without necessarily understanding why, CRM tools, contract management tools, or RMS, recruitment management tools. So I think it actually, and even project management tools, right? Do you use Microsoft Project? Do you use Trello? What do you want to use? Well, do you really know what your project management practice looks like? And that will then maybe determine what kind of tools you need to implement, if that makes sense.
It does. And maybe you can humor me on this. Monitoring tools. As you know, we do monitoring. We produce a monitoring tool. How would you look at monitoring and observability from a capability-led perspective? Let's say for an SRE team or for a monitoring and observability team, IT ops team, however you want to slice your organization?
So to me, there are two types of monitoring involved in DevOps. You've got what's called the production observability, which are your Dynatrace type tools, make sure that you've got your production environments and your applications up, running, all of that. And then what I would call your CI/CD observability tools. And that has to do with how many deployments are you doing to what environments, how many Kubernetes or containers are you creating, how many data seeds are you performing, et cetera. And to me, this second part is where the true challenge lies, because in the first aspect, which is production monitoring, for many years, there was a challenge by many companies of having many different technologies and having to aggregate all of that observability for each one of those tools. So you would have to have your Oracle monitor and then your Topaz monitor for your web. And then you will have some NetCool alerts over here. And all of that would kind of get aggregated mostly through ticketing and alerting systems. However, the same problem has not yet been, in my opinion, fully solved for DevOps, because ideally, if you are orchestrating a pipeline the way that I just mentioned, which is capability first, you're going to end up with a melange of tools. You're not going to end up with a pipeline where the code scanning and the testing and the environment provision is done by the same company and the same tool, which means you're going to have a challenge of how do you now aggregate your observability for your tool provisioning with your observability for your code scanning, for your library scanning, for your environment scanning. And I haven't seen good solutions yet, end to end. What what I've seen done is essentially through Splunk and other aggregation tools trying to roll up that observability into the what's called the orchestrator tool. So if you're using AWS pipelines or you're using Urban Code or you're using any of your orchestration tools, really, that basically their main function is through APIs and quality control gates to talk to the different parts of the pipeline, right? So to me, that is actually a very interesting topic of discussion and not one that I've seen fully solved. So what I've seen is either people end up with 27 views for their 27 pieces of the pipeline, or they end up with a view that is aggregated, but it's really missing details and it's missing actionable information, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. I'd add a third element sort of to the monitoring observability stack. It's actually the underlying infrastructure. So not only related to your production observability, I think the underlying infrastructure, be it on-prem, hybrid, or or cloud-based, I think having an eye on that is essential as well.
So that's actually a great point, right? Because what I've seen done, right? So let's say you've got mainframe and you've got some Linux servers on-prem and then your cloud. What I've seen done is certain pieces just ignored, right? So we're going to do all this infrastructure monitoring for what? For anything that's on a virtual machine. Everything that's not, we're just going to kind of forget about it, right? So that's a very good point that especially in hybrid environments, the infrastructure observability is also not necessarily as smooth and free and through.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, that's where we come into play, but that's a different story. Now, let's maybe end on a little bit of a philosophical question. And you mentioned that you would like to also, if you had the possibility to ask this question of peers, and what do you think is the value of let's say IT in general and maybe DevOps as a culture, as a practice specifically to an organization?
Perfect. So I love this question actually, because it's another thing that I'm passionate about a lot of things, but to me, the relationship between IT and business in general, and business could be an internal business or an external customer, or it could be you, if you're an iPhone user, you are business, right? But to me, the relationship between those two is critical to the actual value of IT. So I grew up in the late 90s, early 2000s, right, where we had the gopher model, right, for most companies. And what is the gopher model? I am business, you're IT. You're akin to a mechanic or a busboy in a restaurant. I'm going to tell you what to do. You're going to do it, even if it means driving the car into the wall. And even if you're telling me, but I'm about to drive the car into the wall. We're going to drive the car into the wall, and then I'm going to yell at you for driving the car into the wall. So that's the gopher model, the old school model. Then you've got a service management model, right, which is more, okay, now I provide a service to you. You can't yell at me. You can't really ask me to do crazy things because I've got this thing called an SLA. But at the same time, because I've got this SLA, as long as I've met my SLA, I'm not going to go far beyond that to actually provide value to you. And this is what I meant about the last few years. The question of value has come into play a lot more, right? Effectiveness versus efficiency, right? And so to me, the final frontier is really the business partnership model, which is where now business, and this applies to most businesses out there, they realize that the value of IT is not just in providing IT solutions, but in the fact that IT as a practice brings a lot of expertises that are not necessarily out there. For example, data analysis expertise, process analysis expertise, process design expertise. Lean Six Sigma is a great example of how most IT practitioners can grab a process and cut it down to a simpler process. So once you have a business partner that realizes that of IT, then suddenly questions about why you want to do something are actually allowed. And when you allow those questions, you end up with a better product. When you actually allow the person designing the solution to understand fully why you actually want something or why you don't want it, you end up with an actual valuable, effective product versus just an implementation, if that makes sense. So to me, that is very important. And then as far as the DevOps portion goes, to me, the value of DevOps and agile practices and IT in general is automation. My biggest philosophy in life that I've coached hundreds of people out there. And the biggest philosophy I try to instill is work yourself out of a job. There's many reasons for it, but the main one is if you don't do it, someone else will do it for you. I've spent my whole career, the first few jobs I had don't exist anymore. The first few jobs I had were moving a bunch of files from this server to that server, changing permissions, making sure they're there, deleting the file over here. Well, that job doesn't exist, but then I could go on through at least 7 or 8 jobs that I had later in life that are no longer out there. They just don't exist. So then to me, the philosophy that is prime for IT success is make sure that whatever you're doing is truly uniquely valuable and that you're not just crossing some T, that you're not just hogging information, like that your value to the company is not that you're the one person that knows where the database is. All of that is not really truly uniquely valuable. It's just working yourself into a job versus out of a job. And it has multiple undertones as far as it doesn't always mean automate your job. Sometimes it might mean train others to do your job with you. Sometimes it might be eliminate the job. A lot of SRE activities don't have to do necessarily with automating a process. They have to do with redesigning or canceling the process altogether. A good SRE knows when to not automate something, if that makes sense. So then to me, that is really the true value of IT, is that you essentially end up with a good culture, if you implement it, of people that really believe that their sole job is to move forward and to never become part of the problem, always part of the solution. So to me, that is the value of IT.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do like that answer. That makes it very tangible, and especially the asking why questions. Why do we actually want to do this? Is I think very crucial in many roles, not just in IT, but.
So that's a great point too, right? So I believe that's true of any partnership, right? Understanding that there's value on both sides, if that makes sense.
Why are we actually doing this? Yeah. Now, when towards the end of these interviews, we always ask our guests a few sort of more lighthearted, tongue-in-cheek questions. So how old were you when you started dabbling with computers?
For about 3 years, I was convincing my parents that if they bought me a Commodore 64, this is in the 80s, that I would become a programmer. And they bought me the Commodore 64, and I started playing video games with it and doing whatever. I used to buy pirated games on cassette, and I would play with the cassette header, screws to get it to work. So I guess that early, about 11, 12 years old, is when I first started messing with computers.
Okay. And how long did it take you to break a computer?
Yeah, so I think I broke that Commodore pretty quickly, but then I think I caused my first outage about my first year of existence in my career by writing a script to automatically drain MQ queues from production. Mm-hmm. And instead of, it was supposed to do it in a lower environment, and I pointed it to production, and I was on my way home when I got a text or a page back then telling me I had broken production. So I think I was 24 when I broke my first enterprise application. It was the last time I broke an enterprise application, if that's any consolation.
At least in production.
At least in production. Oh yeah, exactly.
All right, great. But in the end, sort of what you promised your parents came true. So you became a developer and IT manager. So it might have taken a little bit longer than they might have thought, but in the end, it worked out.
So you know what? I'm calling my dad after this recording, because I'm going to go play that argument with him, see if he flies. Because I agree, you're right. I have never thought of that, but I actually did become a computer person in the end.
Okay, great. Now, I know that the answer to this question is obviously not really either or, but humor me nevertheless. If you'd had to decide, are you more of an open source person, or do you see the value sort of from an enterprise perspective more in the closed source world?
So you're right, it's both. But to be honest with you, to me, it has to do with the type of environment you have to support it. If you have enough controls in place, there's a lot of value to open source, but I grew up in the financial industry. So for me, open source is something that I have to see a very good use case for, or I tend to lean towards closed source. Now, I will say one thing, anything proprietary has to be closed source. Anything that is easily repeatable and multiple people are doing, you might want to consider open source for. But yeah, I tend to lean to closed source just because of my background.
Okay, got it. Now, Oftentimes, the answer to the next question is dictated by our organizations. But if you were free to choose your operating system that you can spend your day with, what would you pick? Linux, Mac, or Windows?
Okay, so to me, for graphic design, it has to be Mac, but I'm not a graphic designer. For personal use, it has to be Windows. But if you're going to do enterprise industrial computing, my experience has been, and I'm very jaded because this is what I know the most, is definitely Linux.
Okay. Yeah. So you actually managed to weave all three of them in. That's great.
I did, but it's definitely Linux, right? So for my craft, for my profession, it's definitely Linux. That's where I've seen the most complicated, highest producing, highest availability systems in my career.
Yeah. So DevOps people and or SREs as well, you know, they're supposed to be half and half between developers and operations. I have seen very few that are exactly half and half. Where do you lean towards sort of the developer coding side of things or more towards the operations configuration side of things?
So I think that's a great question. I think I lean a little bit more towards the operation side, although I can program. But I think it's a philosophical debate that I've had with a few folks since DevOps came along, which is, does a former developer make a better DevOps engineer than a former operations person? And I think it depends on how complex the operations environment. If it was complex enough, then the operations person already knows incident management, problem management, change management, service request management, monitoring, deployment, all of those practices. The only thing they really have to learn is coding practices. Whereas the developer, I found, has to learn a lot more practices to become a full-fledged DevOps engineer, from infrastructure to code deployment, release management, a lot of things that they didn't traditionally learn. But that said, I really think it has to do with your drive towards working yourself out of a job. So I've seen some really good developers turn DevOps and some really good operations folks turns DevOps. But personally, I tend to lean more towards the operations. I'm more of a generalist, so I like to get myself into all sorts of different things. So, yeah.
All right. Yeah, that's actually a great way to think about it. I've never seen it that way. But yes, I mean, as you said, if it's complex enough, you'll have, and you've operated in that for a few years, you've seen a lot. That is definitely true. Now, we're nearing the end. Is there anything that you are particularly interested in, where you could want to address our audience, something that's very important to you, or, you know, something they would like people to reach out to you about?
So I'm interested in any conversation that has to do with overall shape of talent management in the company, in the industry. And the reason I say that is what I'm passionate about, which is, I don't necessarily see most companies put enough effort into talent acquisition and retention. I see some turnover in some places that is probably unhealthy. So to me, what I would say is anything that has to do with talent development and talent management or process management is something that I'm interested in. What I would beg people to do out there is, if you've got a good engineer out there, try to listen to them, because my final word of advice out there to prospective leaders in operations is, try to listen to all of the voices in the room, even the ones that might be drowned out because of the culture. Because sometimes the most thoughtful, most widespread solutions come from people who may or may not be having the space to talk. So to me, it's about making sure that you listen to the entire team, even the person in the corner. So that'd be my request, my open request to leaders and managers out there.
Amen to that. Now, if people would want to get in touch with you, what's the best way? Is it LinkedIn? Are you on Twitter? Do you have a
TikTok? Yeah, I'm not really. I'm a little too old to be on Twitter. Let's put it that way. So yeah, LinkedIn is really where I'm most active and the best way to get in touch with me, at Juan Cercos, as you mentioned, CERCOS.
All right. Well, we will link to your LinkedIn profile in the show notes, then people can find you there. Juan, this has been tremendously fun. I really thought that you made some excellent points, especially around sort of people within the IT and DevOps organization. So thank you for that. Thank you for the time. And yeah, looking forward to continuing this conversation at some other point.
It was a lot of fun, Elias. I really, really appreciate the opportunity to discuss these fun topics. Very interesting.
All right. Great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the All Things Ops podcast. If you liked this episode, leave us a review and subscribe on your favorite podcast player. This podcast has been brought to you by Tribe 29, the CheckMK company. For more resources, head over to checkmk.com/podcast. If you want to send us feedback or suggest a guest, please drop us an email at podcast@checkmk.com. Until next time, happy monitoring.